content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward with the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the March 31st, 2023 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week shows just the torso of a man. He's in a familiar-looking dark blue suit with a red tie. His hands are extended in front of him, and they are handcuffed. The headline is, First of Many, Why a Hush Money Charge is the Least of Trump's Legal Troubles. That is our first main story. We will start right there. Trump facing hush money indictment. What happened? The first ever criminal indictment of a former president loomed this week as Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg was reportedly on the verge of charging Donald Trump in connection with a hush money payoff to a porn star. The case involves a $130,000 payment made in the run-up to the 2016 election to Stormy Daniels, a porn actress who'd had a tryst with Trump a decade earlier. According to a 2018 criminal case that yielded a three-year jail term for former Trump fixer Michael Cohen, Cohen paid Daniels the money so she wouldn't go public about the dalliance and was reimbursed by Trump's company with payments designated as legal fees. Trump is expected to be charged with falsifying business records and possibly violating campaign finance law on the premise that the secret payment was an unreported donation to his campaign. Trump has admitted to the payment but denied having sex with Daniels and any wrongdoing. On Truth Social, Trump told followers he would soon be arrested and called on them to protest and take our nation back. We must save America. Congressional Republicans circled their wagons around Trump, attacking Bragg for what they branded a politically motivated prosecution. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy said an indictment would be an outrageous abuse of power. House Judiciary Committee Chair Jim Jordan and other committee Republicans demanded Bragg turn over documents related to the investigation and testify before Congress. Bragg's office issued a statement saying, "We will not be intimidated." The Manhattan case is just the first of many possible indictments faced by Trump. In Fulton County, Georgia, a grand jury is weighing whether to indict Trump for pressuring state officials to change the vote count in the 2020 election. Special Counsel Jack Smith is investigating Trump's role in the January 6th insurrection and a fake elector scheme. Smith is also in on Trump's role in allegedly hiding and refusing to turn over more than 100 classified documents he brought to Mar-a-Lago. Smith persuaded a federal judge this week to demand Trump's lawyer testify in the documents case under the crime fraud exception. The judge said there was convincing evidence Trump committed criminal violations. What the editorial said. It's impossible to overstate Mr. Bragg's bad judgment in pursuing this indictment, said the Wall Street Journal. He's resurrecting a weak 7-year-old case that may lead to an acquittal if he charges Trump with violating campaign finance laws. Trump can plausibly say he made the payment because he wanted to shield the affair from his wife. A show trial will unleash a political firestorm and might even boost Trump's 2024 candidacy. The spectacle of a former president sitting for a mugshot might be shocking, said the Philadelphia Inquirer. But given the multiple criminal investigations swirling around Trump, the coming indictment is no surprise. Cohen went to prison for these payments. So why is the client who benefited from them not accountable? Republicans should let a jury decide Trump's guilt or innocence rather than embrace his lies and gaslighting. What the columnist said, an indictment in this relatively trivial case would be a farce, said Rich Lowry in the New York Post. A man who stands accused of fomenting an insurrection to overthrow the Constitution is going to be hauled into court for allegedly paying hush money to a porn star. Those are laughably weak grounds for the historic first-ever indictment of a former president. A nakedly partisan political prosecution will only rally Trump supporters around him in the GOP nomination fight with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. Even Democrats who long to see Trump in handcuffs worry privately this could be a political loser, said Alexei McCammond in Axios. They fear a case that could amount to a mere record-keeping infraction may undermine more serious cases that are gathering force, making it easier for Trump to cast any future charges as a witch hunt. Trump indictments are coming, probably several of them, said Jonathan Bernstein in Bloomberg. The GOP might initially rally around Trump, but as his legal jeopardy grows, it's easy to imagine Republican fence-sitters deciding indictments were the last straw. Not incidentally, France, Italy, and many other democracies have prosecuted former presidents and prime ministers without devolving into banana republics. So much for Republicans' stated desire to move on from Trump, said Kurt Bardella in the Los Angeles Times. Instead of seizing on the pending Manhattan indictment as the off-ramp they yearn for, McCarthy, Jordan, and the rest are serving as Trump's accomplices, using their power to threaten and obstruct Bragg and shield Trump from prosecution. The same cabal has complained about the prosecution and imprisonment of January 6 insurrectionist. The GOP's message is clear. If you investigate crimes that may have been committed by prominent Republicans, we will investigate you. What next? If Trump is indicted as expected, said Erica Orden in Politico, he'll be asked to come to New York for arraignment, probably within a week. He'll then report to Bragg's office, where he'll be arrested and booked, fingerprinted, and have his mugshot taken. He'll then be taken to a judge, possibly in handcuffs, and arraigned, at which point the charges against him will be made public, and he'll enter a plea of guilty or not guilty. Trump will then be given a court date and released, and will almost certainly be allowed to return to Florida or go anywhere else he chooses. New York law enforcement officials are preparing for possible unrest following an indictment, said Martin Pengali in The Guardian. Barricades have been erected around the Manhattan criminal courthouse and security cameras installed. Police officers have been alerted to be ready for deployment. Officials are monitoring a spike in online threats from right-wing extremists, but say they've identified no credible threats. Controversy of the week. Iraq, two decades later, a reckoning. 20 years ago this week, the United States invaded Iraq, said Murtada Ghazar in the Los Angeles Times. But for Iraqis like me, the war isn't a distant memory. It's our daily devastation. When the U.S. campaign of shock and awe first drove Saddam Hussein from his palace, Iraqis briefly dared to hope we had been liberated, as George W. Bush and Dick Cheney insisted we had been. But freedom didn't materialize. Instead, America's intervention led to two hellish decades of brutal civil wars, political turmoil, widespread corruption, and the medieval horror of ISIS. At least 500,000 Iraqi lives were lost in a now shattered nation that many Americans still can't find on a map. For the invaders, it was also a major loss, said Ishan Tharoor in the Washington Post. More than 4,500 U.S. troops died in Iraq, and tens of thousands suffered catastrophic injuries. All told, the war's cost in dollars will exceed $2 trillion, including care for the 300,000 soldiers who returned with post-traumatic disorders. All to disarm Saddam of weapons he did not possess, and to satisfy America's vengeful post-9/11 bloodlust. America made terrible mistakes in Iraq, said Jeff Jacoby in the Boston Globe, but the decision to invade was still the right call. The conventional wisdom today is that Bush and Cheney tricked us into war with lies about Saddam's non-existent weapons of mass destruction. It's now forgotten that Saddam had not only deployed chemical weapons, but also used them to kill thousands of Iranians and Iraqi Kurds. After 9/11, concerns about Saddam grew infinitely more pressing, but he played games with UN weapons inspectors and defiantly hinted he had the ability to strike its enemies. In hindsight, we know he was bluffing, but Saddam did retain the ability to restart his deadly biological and chemical weapons programs on short notice. After 9/11, it would have been unthinkable for the U.S. to ignore that very real threat. We also went to war to build a democracy in Iraq, said former Bush speechwriter David Frum in The Atlantic. That did not work well either. Iraq has elections, but its governments have been unstable and corrupt, and the country functions barely as a soft partition among Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds. Still, it's fair to ask, if the U.S. had left Saddam in place in 2003, would Iraq and the Middle East be better off? No, said Michael Rubin in the Washington Examiner. Iraq's democracy may be fractured and messy, but people do vote for their leaders, and oil revenue is booming. Had the U.S. not intervened, Iraq today would be ruled either by an 85-year-old Saddam, still savagely torturing dissidents and opponents, or by one of his two incompetent sociopath sons. At least Iraqis now have a chance to forge their own future. Nothing can justify the barbarism I witnessed as a U.S. soldier in Iraq, said Will Selber in the Bulwark. The streets were strewn with corpses, including children who'd been raped, gagged, and killed, and men who'd been tortured to death and left with IEDs in their carved-out stomachs. Surrounded by insurgents we couldn't distinguish from civilians, we saw our own comrades shredded by roadside bombs and blown away by snipers. 2 decades later, there is no cost-benefit analysis of the war that can lessen the burden of guilt, shame, and remorse that so many of us still carry and still wrestle with every night when the demons come. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for Finland, which has been named the world's happiest country by the UN World Happiness Report for a 6th straight year. The Finns, the report said, enjoy relatively long life expectancy, high per capita wealth, personal freedom, and strong social bonds. It was a good week for dad jokes, which may help children's psychological development. A new study found the cringing embarrassment caused by a dad's lame, punny jokes teaches kids how to endure awkward moments. It was a good week for hints. After President Biden strongly suggested that he will seek re-election at a White House event honoring people in the arts, while congratulating novelist Colson Whitehead for winning 2 Pulitzer Prizes, Biden said he is kind of looking for back-to-back myself. To Bruce Springsteen, he joked, "Some people are born to run." But it was a bad week for country life. after new research found that rural Americans are more depressed, anxious, and generally less satisfied than city dwellers. There is a pressing need to identify the psychological, social, and structural mechanisms responsible, researchers said. It was a bad week for SWAG, with a report that former President Donald Trump failed to report to the State Department 117 gifts worth $291,000 that he received from foreign leaders and governments. Some of the gifts, including a flattering portrait of Trump, have gone missing. Finally, it was a bad week for wordplay. After tourism officials in Regina, Canada, pronounced Regina, apologized for sexualizing the city with two new slogans, "Show us your Regina," and "Regina, the city that rhymes with fun." The slogans, officials conceded, crossed the line. And a short and other news piece while we're here. Biden's first veto quashes ESG bill. President Biden issued his first veto this week, rejecting a GOP-backed bill that would have barred retirement plan managers from considering environmental and social factors in investing decisions. The bill received support from Democrat Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and John Tester of Montana in a mostly party-line House vote. This bill would risk your retirement savings by making it illegal to consider risk factors MAGA House Republicans don't like, Biden tweeted. The Labor Department rule in question lets plan participants choose funds that prioritize environmental, social, and governance, or ESG, factors. More than $18 trillion is held in ESG funds, a focus of GOP complaints about woke Wall Street. The briefing this week is titled Targeting the Press. Some public officials want to roll back long-standing legal protections for journalists. Might they succeed? What's the origin of libel law? Before the Revolutionary War, any criticism of colonial officials was considered seditious libel, a criminal offense under English common law. It did not matter if critical statements about authorities were true. That changed with America's first landmark libel case in 1735. John Peter Zenger, printer of the New York Weekly Journal, had angered the crown-appointed governor, William Cosby, with frequent criticism and mockery. Cosby and Zenger had Zenger jailed and tried for sedition, but his lawyer argued that people have a natural right to complain about malevolent or incompetent rulers, and convinced a jury to acquit Zenger on the grounds that the paper's criticisms were true. The principle that the truth cannot be libelous became a bedrock of American free speech law and was incorporated into the laws of many states after the U.S. was founded. But until the mid-20th century, state laws put the burden of proof on defendants to show their statements were true. That changed with the 1964 Supreme Court case, New York Times versus Sullivan, which set a groundbreaking precedent. What did the Sullivan ruling say? L.B. Sullivan was a city commissioner in Alabama who sued the New York Times for defamation over an ad placed by civil rights activists accusing Alabama police of mistreating protesters. Sullivan said the ad got several minor details wrong and won a $500,000 jury verdict. But the Supreme Court unanimously overturned that verdict and set a new libel standard. Plaintiffs must prove actual malice, that the defendant published a statement without knowledge or with knowledge that it was false or with reckless disregard of whether it was false or not. Erroneous statements are inevitable in free debate, wrote Justice William Brennan, declaring that debate on public issues should be uninhibited, robust, and wide open. Subsequent rulings extended the actual malice standard to public figures as well as government officials. The standard for libeling private individuals is lower. The news organization or accuser must be found to have acted with negligence in making a false, damaging statement. Free speech advocates say Sullivan's standards have been crucial to the functioning of a free press, but some Republicans say the ruling should be overturned. Why do they think so? They say the actual malice standard makes it too hard for public officials to successfully sue news organizations. Donald Trump, who last year sued CNN for libel for airing statements that he's a racist and Russian lackey, has frequently said legislators or courts should open up libel laws so he and others could sue news outlets that write purposely negative and horrible and false articles. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, a frequent press combatant, has also assailed the Sullivan standards, saying they enable the press to smear public figures. Two bills his allies recently introduced in the Florida legislature would drastically weaken reporters' legal protections. How would the bills do that? One provision would establish a presumption that statements by anonymous sources are false and compel reporters to reveal such sources. Accusing public officials or religious leaders of discrimination against gays, women, or racial minorities would be deemed libelous. The bills put the onus on news organizations to validate or corroborate the alleged defamatory statement. Plaintiffs who won such suits would get all legal fees paid by losing media organizations. Critics of the proposal say that if that new standard were established, the press could face a blizzard of lawsuits that would lead to financial ruin even if the suits failed. It's a deliberative effort to punish media organizations that criticize DeSantis, said Thomas Julin, a Florida First Amendment attorney. If the bills became law, their constitutionality would be challenged, giving conservatives on the U.S. Supreme Court a chance to revisit the Sullivan ruling and possibly overturn it. There's a growing sense among Sullivan opponents that this is their day, said veteran First Amendment lawyer Floyd Abrams. Would the court do that? Justices Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch have both criticized the Sullivan standard. It has evolved into an ironclad subsidy for the publication of falsehoods, wrote Gorsuch last year. How many other justices might potentially vote to overturn Sullivan is unclear. But First Amendment lawyers believe it's a matter of time before the court chooses to hear a challenge to that precedent. What's at stake? If libel standards are lowered, said the First Amendment advocates, it would lead to a flood of lawsuits designed to stifle criticism of government officials and inhibit investigative journalism. It would have a chilling effect on the press, said Samantha Barbas, a University of Buffalo law professor, who wrote a book on the Sullivan case. Under a lowered standard, however, conservative media outlets like Fox News, which routinely attack people on the left in very caustic personal terms, would also become vulnerable, said Edward Burke, a First Amendment lawyer in Florida. These kinds of changes will cut far right and far left and everywhere in between. time to read a few of the best columns of the week, starting with Alternatives to Angry Populists. The conventional wisdom is that the Republican presidential nominee in 2024 will be one of two anti-woke populists, Donald Trump or Governor Ron DeSantis, said David Brooks. But what if the primaries offered Republican voters an actual choice between angry, grievance-based populism and the optimistic conservatism of one of the popular Republican governors in Georgia, New Hampshire, and Virginia? In Georgia, Governor Brian Kemp, who refused to go along with Trump's big lie, has made his state a hub for green manufacturing, attracting big investments in electric vehicle technology that create jobs and prosperity. Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin and New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu also offer viable center-right pragmatism and are warm, upbeat people who actually enjoy their fellow human beings. Contrast that with the dour, humorless culture warrior DeSantis. Do Republicans really think a guy with a small, insular circle of advisors and limited personal skills is going to do well in the intimate contest in Iowa and New Hampshire? Voters are already getting sick of relentless culture war battles, and by 2024 will be hungry for a fresh message. If Republicans want to offer a sunnier, forward-looking vision in 2024, they have good alternatives. This column is from Spain. Drought is spreading across Europe. A ban on watering lawns and gardens, a mandatory 40% reduction in the use of water for irrigating crops, the closure of public drinking fountains. This isn't happening in the middle of August, said Nuno Brito Jorge. In Catalonia, where I've been living, it's the reality in early March. Some 6 million people here are currently affected by water restrictions. That's because last year was the driest in a century for this region of eastern Spain. We've been in what's categorized as severe drought for 30 parched months, leaving reservoirs that supply cities such as Girona and Barcelona at just 28% capacity. The rest of southern Europe is at risk of following, and sooner than you think. Some Portuguese cities are under water restrictions already. Lac de Montbel, a reservoir in southern France, is just 20% full, while tourists visiting Italy's Lake Garda can now walk to the small island of San Biagio, usually accessible only by boat, because the water level is 2 feet below average. This year could be even deadlier than last year, when heat waves across Western Europe claimed some 20,000 lives. If we add to the prolonged periods of drought the increase in the frequency and intensity of heat waves, we have the perfect recipe for tragedy. This column comes from Malaysia. Michelle Yeoh deserves to be celebrated. You'd think that Malaysians would be cheering the Best Actress Oscar won by our own Michelle Yeoh, said Wong Chun-wai in The Star. With her star turn in Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, the Malaysian-born ethnic Chinese actress became the first Asian to take home the statuette. Instead of pouring accolades on her, though, her homeland has been buzzing about a viral critique that called Yeoh out for pursuing her film career in Hong Kong and the U.S. Of course, the idea that she should have stayed here is ridiculous. Malaysia is just too small a market for her to bloom. That's the harsh reality. It's likely that the real beef Malaysians have with Yeoh isn't with her work. Many are still upset about her political activity a decade ago when she campaigned for then Prime Minister Najib Razak. He has since been convicted of corruption in connection with the looting of billions from the 1MDB state fund. But Yeoh is not to blame for Najib's crimes. In fact, while Najib is a national embarrassment, Yeo is probably the only other Malaysian, besides shoe magnate Jimmy Choo, who has achieved international recognition. Before we sneer at Yeo and diminish her success, perhaps we should also ask ourselves humbly what we have done for Malaysia. The last word, our feature article, a perfect Aryan child. The Nazis created Lebensborn homes for illegitimate children of the SS they believed would be genetically superior, said Valentine Foire in The Atlantic. After the war, the kids were abandoned. In the small elementary school in the Joux-sur-le-Coult in northern France, Giselle Marc knew the rumor about her, that her parents were not her real parents, and her real mother must have been a whore. It was the late 1940s, just after the war, a time when whispered stories like this one passed from parents to children. Women who were said to have slept with occupying soldiers, horizontal collaborators, had their heads shaved and were publicly shamed by angry crowds. In the schoolyard, children jeered at those who were said to be born of unknown fathers. The idea that Giselle might have been abandoned by someone of ill repute made her terribly ashamed. At the age of 10, she gathered her courage and confronted her mother, who told her the truth. We adopted you when you were 4 years old. You spoke German, but now you are French. Giselle and her mother hardly ever talked about it again. Giselle found her adoption file hidden in a drawer in her parents' room, and from time to time she snuck a look at it. It contained little information. When she was 18, she burned it on the stove. I said to myself, if I want to live, I have to get rid of all this, she told me. Janelle is 79 now, and she does not regret burning the papers. For a time, she was able to put aside questions about her origins. At 17, she took a job in a children's home and hospital and realized she had found her calling. She spent her career working mainly in daycare centers and eventually founded her own. In 1972, she married Justin Nyong'o, a chemistry student from the Ivory Coast. They bought an old hotel just behind Stanislaus Square in Nancy and turned it into a house. I visited Giselle there in June. It was easy to imagine the vibrant family life that once took place inside. Her children, Virginie, Gabrielle, Gregor, and Matthew, running up and down stairs and playing instruments in their rooms. At school, they were sometimes the only black kids in their class. Giselle has a lot of stories about the cruel comments made through the years. All the stories end with her confronting the culprit. Giselle held off telling her children that she had been adopted because she was worried that the revelation might weaken their bonds with her parents. When her mother died in 2004, she gathered her children and told them. They were shocked and asked questions whose answers she did not know. After years of denial, Giselle longed to find those answers. She remembered the name and place of birth that had been listed in her burned adoption file. Gisela Magula, born in Bar-le-Duc in northeastern France. She started her research there and went on to write to the Arolsen Archives, the International Center on Nazi Persecution in Germany, to ask if there were any mention of her in the organization's extensive records. In March 2005, Giselle received a reply. She had not been born in Bar-le-Duc, after all, but near Liège, Belgium, in a Nazi maternity home at the Château de Wegemont. That home and others like it had been set up by the SS, an elite corps of Nazi soldiers, under the umbrella of the Lebensborn Association, through which the regime sought to encourage the birth of babies of good blood in order to hasten its ultimate goal of Aryan racial purity. Everything Giselle believed about herself wavered. The family she'd spent her adult life defending against racism, she realized, descended from one of history's darkest racial projects. Nazism was an ideology of destruction, one that held as its primary aim the elimination of inferior races. But another equally fervent aspect of the Nazi credo was focused on an imagined form of restoration. As soon as they came to power, the Nazis set out to produce a new generation of pure-blooded Germans. The Lebensborn, Fount of Life, Association was a key part of this plan. Established in 1935 under the auspices of the SS, it was intended to encourage procreation among members of the Aryan race by providing birthing mothers with comfort, financial support, and, when necessary, secrecy. The SS was overseen by Heinrich Himmler, who hoped that its elite soldiers would serve as a racial vanguard for revitalized Germanity. Himmler had no problem with childbearing outside marriage and criticized the Catholic Church's hostility toward illegitimate births. Raising illegitimate or orphan children of good blood should be an accepted custom, Himmler wrote. In 1939, he issued an order that called on members of the SS to procreate wherever they could, including with women whom they were not married. According to Himmler, the Lebensborn homes were intended primarily for the brides and wives of our young SS men, and secondarily for illegitimate mothers of good blood. But the latter were, in practice, a majority. Far from the eyes of the world, single mothers could give birth in Lebensborn homes and, if they wanted to, abandon their babies. Who would receive the best care before being placed in an adopted family, so long as the biological parents met the racial criteria? Photos of both were required. By October 11, 1943, when Giselle was born, there were about 16 Lebensborn facilities in Nazi-occupied Europe. One afternoon last spring, I sat with Giselle in her living room, dozens of documents and photographs spread out before us. A short woman whose white hair is shot through with a streak of brown, Giselle is at once reserved and straightforward, with a wry sense of humor. Himmler really bungled with me, she joked, referencing her marriage to an African man and their mixed-race family. A chance encounter helped Giselle trace her origins. A few months after her mother's death, just as she began her research, her cousin went to a funeral where a tall man with blonde hair gave a eulogy for the departed, a teacher who had believed in him. The man, Walter Bossert, talked about his arrival in France as a child in a convoy from Germany. Giselle's cousin, who was old enough to remember Giselle's adoption, struck up a conversation with Bossert. Her cousin wondered whether Giselle might have been in the same convoy. Bossert was a Lebensborn child. A decade earlier, he had been the first person in France to testify about the Lebensborn in a 1994 television report on his quest throughout Europe to find where he was born. Giselle's cousin put her in touch with Bossert, and Bossert, who in fact had been in the same convoy and Center for Displaced Children, soon helped Giselle recover her own history. The story that Giselle has pieced together is still full of holes, but she now knows the identity of her biological mother. Marguerite Magula was a Hungarian woman who immigrated to Brussels with her parents and sister in 1926. Marguerite eventually went to Germany to work with her mother and sister in a garment factory in Saarbrücken. When she got pregnant in 1943, she ran away and returned to Brussels. Giselle's feelings toward Marguerite have changed over time. When she learned from the Steinhuring archives that some mothers had searched for their children after the war, trying to get them back, Giselle came to hate her. "She never sought me out," Giselle said. "I have no compassion, nothing. Quite the opposite. That's not a mother." Giselle has been less curious about the identity of her father. She imagines him as the stereotype of an SS officer, undoubtedly a bastard. In 2009, Giselle met a half-brother, Claude, born after the war, who was raised by Marguerite. They still visit each other from time to time. Claude, she said, describes their mother as having mistreated him. He once told Giselle she was lucky not to have grown up with their mother. In the summer of 1945, Life magazine published a report with pictures by the photographer Robert Kappa on the super babies of a Lebensborn home. The Hohenhorst bastards of Himmler's men are blue-eyed, flaxen-haired, and pig-fat, one caption read. "Too much porridge, plenty of sunlight have made this Nazi baby in hand-knitted suit and booties so fat and healthy that he completely fills his oversized carriage," read another. Grown pig fat under care and overstuffing Nazi nurses, they now pose to the Allies a problem yet to be solved. The tone gives an idea of the level of resentment that Americans and Europeans felt in 1945 toward those who were spared the war's horrors, even toddlers. But not all Lebensborn babies were blue-eyed, flaxen-haired, or even, for that matter, pig-fat. Likely because of the lack of bonding with a caregiver, some children were developmentally delayed. For Giselle and her fellow Lebensborn children, the Allies' liberation of Belgium marked the beginning of a journey. In wicker cradles wedged in the back of military trucks through a devastated Europe. In the 9 years the program lasted, at least 9,200 children were born in the homes. Some 1,200 were born in Norway, which had the most SS maternity homes outside Germany. Until the 1970s, however, the homes were treated largely as a rumor. When the news of Hitler's death broke, officials burned as many documents as they could. The French journalist Boris Thiollet describes the goals of this purge in the Factory of Perfect Children. The birth registers, the identity of the children, the fathers, the organization chart, the names of the people in charge, everything must disappear. The evidence of the Lebensborn's very existence must be removed. But the Nazis' obsession with documents made fully expunging the records an impossible task. There were too many. After several stops in Germany and Poland, Giselle and Walter were transferred to Kloster Indersdorf, 9 miles from Dachau, where they were housed in a 12th-century monastery. There, the Lebensborn children lived together with survivors, Jewish children who had made it out of the concentration camps, as well as Eastern and Central European Gentile teenagers who had been forced laborers during the war. Were they survivors, these toddlers who owed their existence to Nazi birth policy, who ate fresh fruit and porridge while other babies were gassed or starved to death? On October 10, 1947, in Nuremberg, four Lebensborn leaders appeared before a special American military tribunal as part of the subsequent Nuremberg trials, which prosecuted ancillary Nazi leaders. Three charges were brought against them: crimes against humanity, war crimes, and membership in a criminal organization. Three out of the four leaders were found guilty of the third charge, but the tribunal established that the Lebensborn had been only a welfare institution. The children, therefore, were not considered victims. At home in Nancy, Giselle keeps a photograph of her biological mother on display, though she doesn't look at it much anymore. "It's my heritage. I don't want to forget that I was born from this woman," she told me. All she wants now is for her story to be told. "I'm modest," she joked. "I want the whole world to know about it." Her son Gabriel married a German woman, and her grandchildren speak German, a language she has completely forgotten. "It shows that history goes on," she said. Her son Matthew is working on a book about the Lebensborn, and with his wife Camille, he wrote a play about the children's story. "Recently, I attended a reading at a small theater in Paris. I watched Giselle seated next to her daughter, Virginie, as she watched her own story acted out." "They say history is written by the victors," one actor said. "But most of all, it's written by the adults." Giselle discreetly dried her tears behind her glasses. This was adapted from a story originally published in The Atlantic. We'll read a couple of the health and science short pieces this week. First up, A Tale of Two Africas. Africa is slowly, very slowly, splitting into two pieces. The continent sits on three tectonic plates, the Nubian, the Somali, and the Arabian. All three are gradually pulling away from one another, reports QZ.com, with fault lines widening by a quarter of an inch every year. The motion of the Arabian plate already led to the creation of the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden millions of years ago. Now another continental drift is taking place along the East African Rift Valley, a geologically active area stretching through Ethiopia and Kenya. Eventually, in about 5 million to 10 million years, that will break the land mass into two, cleaving off Somalia, a chunk of Ethiopia, and most of Kenya and Tanzania. A new ocean basin will fill in between the remaining larger pieces of Africa and the much smaller new continent. This process became alarmingly noticeable in 2005 in Ethiopia's Afar Desert, where three tectonic plates meet, when a volcano erupted and caused a 35-mile-long chasm to emerge. Further confirmation came in 2018, when a similar crack emerged in the Kenyan town of Narok. The plate movement at the boundary brings about tension forces, says Mercy Bure, a geologist at the Baringo Technical College in Kenya's Rift Valley. The fact that the mantle where the magma comes from is part of Earth's crust is reason enough for further rifting. Seaweed blob approaches. A 5,000-mile-wide patchy mess of brown seaweed, so vast it can be seen from space, is heading for Florida. The seaweed, known as the Great Atlantic Sargassum Belt, floats harmlessly most of the year, providing shelter and breeding grounds for sea creatures. When it reaches ashore, though, it starts to rot, producing toxic fumes and pollution that can choke vital habitats and drive tourists from beaches. Some seaweed from the belt generally arrives in the Gulf of Mexico in May, but this year it has already reached the Florida Keys, as well as Mexican resort beaches like Cancun and Tulum, and is piling up in huge globs. These blooms are getting bigger and bigger, and this year looks like it's going to be the biggest year on record, Brian LaPointe from Florida Atlantic University tells the New York Times. It just doesn't bode well for a clean beach summer. Scientists still aren't sure why or how the mass of seaweed is expanding. LaPointe says it may be getting fed with nitrogen and phosphorus from the runoff from major waterways, including the Congo, Amazon, and Mississippi rivers. And we'll flip over to the Talking Points page. We have an article titled, Ukraine, the Growing GOP Rift. The schism is here, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. Republicans are fracturing over Ukraine. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis went on Tucker Carlson's Fox News show last week to pander to the GOP's pro-Kremlin MAGA wing, calling Russia's genocidal invasion of Ukraine a territorial dispute and arguing that Ukraine's victory isn't a vital U.S. interest. By bending a knee to Carlson, DeSantis aligned himself on Ukraine with his chief 2024 presidential rival, former President Trump. But DeSantis' cynical attempt to win over Trump voters brought cutting condemnations from traditional conservative hawks, such as Senators Marco Rubio of Florida and Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. Graham even likened DeSantis to Neville Chamberlain, the British leader who sought to appease Hitler. The party of Reagan, said David French in the New York Times, is now dominated by two men who represent weakness, insularity, and moral ambiguity in the face of Vladimir Putin's evil. Don't let them Reagan shame you, Ron, said Michael Brendan Doherty in National Review. GOP hawks are quick to invoke Reagan and the Cold War anytime a Republican questions whether it's wise to endlessly bankroll the Ukrainian military. But a lot has changed since Reagan was president. Today's Kremlin is not possessed by a universal and totalizing ideology like communism, unlike China. That might explain why a recent poll found that 47% of Republicans say we are doing too much to help Ukraine. Clearly, Republican hawks who castigated DeSantis don't speak for the GOP base. The party's view is far from fixed, said John Podhoretz in commentary. A recent Gallup poll found that a majority of Republicans support Ukraine's effort to reclaim territory from Russia, even if that prolongs the conflict, 53% to 41%. Political calculations aside, DeSantis' assessment is shameful, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine, describing the war as a territorial dispute absolves Russia of blame for its unprovoked invasion across internationally recognized borders, the subsequent razing of cities, and the innumerable war crimes perpetrated against Ukrainian civilians. DeSantis' call for peace implies that Ukraine should simply surrender to Russia's territorial demands. That will be heard loud and clear in Moscow, where Putin now has every reason to believe he simply needs to hang on until the Republicans take office again. And we'll get into some of the shorter notes. Road rage shootings roughly doubled from 2018 to 2022, a period when U.S. firearm sales surged. Last year, 550 people were shot in road rage incidents, 141 of them fatally. States that allow carrying a concealed gun without a permit had nearly triple the rate of road rage incidents involving a gun compared with states with the most stringent gun control standards. COVID infections in pregnant women were a major factor in a 40% increase in maternal deaths in the U.S. in 2021, according to a new CDC report. Pregnant women who get COVID face a sevenfold risk of dying compared with uninfected pregnant women. U.S. officials recovered a record 890 bodies of dead migrants along the border between September 2021 and September 2022. They include those who died from dehydration, falls, and drowning in the Rio Grande, and 53 migrants found dead in a broiling abandoned tractor trailer near San Antonio. Federal prosecutors investigating Donald Trump's social media company are examining a pair of loans totaling $8 million to rescue his failing firm made by obscure financial companies with ties to Russia. The loans, wired to Trump media through the Caribbean, were from companies controlled in part by a relative of an ally of Russian President Vladimir Putin. On the poll watch, in 2003, 66% of Americans approved of military action in Iraq, and 57% falsely believed that Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein was involved in the 9/11 attacks. 2 decades later, 61% of Americans say the U.S. was wrong to invade Iraq. Just 31%, including 44% of Republicans and 24% of Democrats, believe the war made the U.S. safer. And we've time for two of the quotes here. Let's start with Ogden Nash, who says, "Middle age is when you've met so many people that every new person you meet reminds you of someone else." And talent agent Michael Ovitz, quoted in the Wall Street Journal, says, "Hollywood is like high school with money." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.